Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. State lawmakers are considering a handful of bills to change how the state responds to school districts in academic distress. Current law, passed about 4 years ago, says the state takes over any district that receives three consecutive failing grades on the state report card. Dayton schools are scheduled for state takeover this summer. Columbus and other districts face takeovers after next school year. Some have questioned the process, and Governor Mike DeWine has said that he's open to reviewing the law. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us is Dayton Daily News state government reporter Laura Bischoff. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Columbus Dispatch reporter Marty Schladen. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann.
And Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome back.
Hey.
Andy, I think you've kind of written a small book on this topic of school takeovers. What's going on? What are the alternatives that they're thinking about?
So we actually have three different bills in the State House that are sort of circulating right now. Two are in the House. One are in the Senate. One is in the Senate. You have one bill that is basically the take a hammer to everything, get rid of all the current academic distress commissions, don't start any other new academic distress commissions, and instead create what are called community learning centers. And the idea behind this is to bring in more buy-in from local leaders and local groups, local community organizations to help really guide that school district forward, just to get more local buy-in. So people are seeing that as the repeal and replace model. There's another bill in the House that would be the moratorium. So don't start any new academic distress commissions. You can continue with the one that's currently in Lorain, the one that's currently in Youngstown, and the one that's currently in East Cleveland. But you should note that East Cleveland is also fighting their status in court right now, too. So that's a little bit in limbo, even though they are under academic distress.
So what's the gripe about the process?
So the process here is that it's considered a takeover by the state, that the state comes in and takes over the school district, creates this academic distress commission. It's a 5-member board. Three of those members are appointed by the state superintendent. I think only a handful have to be from the local community, so they could be from somewhere just completely different. So it might not necessarily be all Youngstown people who are in Youngstown, or Lorain or East Cleveland. And then they have the CEO, and that CEO becomes sort of the big boss of everything that's going on. And again, that CEO—
In that district. It's like a superintendent.
Exactly. But I would say probably with even more control. And so it's just a lot of taking over, taking control away from those locally elected school board members and putting it in the hands of this 5-member academic distress commission. And critics have noted that these schools have not gotten any better. They have not shown any signs of improving in their academic achievement. So that's the moratorium model. And then there's a third bill in the Senate that would be probably, for lack of a better word, the weakest of the three. It would just make tweaks to the current system, where it would keep that academic distress commission, but allow for the local school board members, the locally elected school board members, to have more say, more oversight, more accountability into the process.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Andy Chow. We're talking about the process by which school districts are taken over when they receive three consecutive failing grades on their state report card. Mm-hmm. There's three bills pending, two in the House, one in the Senate, that would change that one way or another. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. There's no evidence that these state takeovers help. The law has been around for 4 years. What were they hoping to achieve with this law?
Well, you got to remember, this is when Governor John Kasich was in place, and this sort of followed his philosophy in governing in a lot of ways of he wanted more control. He wanted the state to have more control in all sorts of different areas of whether it's state government, local government, especially in education. He wanted more state control. So that's kind of where it went from there. But again, it just hasn't been. They haven't been seeing the success in the metrics that they've wanted to see it in.
You know, I think that the state, taxpayers in general, and you know, families, we want to have more accountability in the education system. We want to see the system working, but I don't know that you know just because a state takes it over that they have some sort of magic wand or secret sauce to fix what are really entrenched problems
of poverty
and you know, the achievement gaps and funding issues. You know, maybe a lack of parent involvement. You know, and getting their kids ready for school, and it, you know, I think that there's a, it is a very complex problem, mm-hmm.
And by the way, these aren't fancy suburban districts. These are
it's across the state.
Low wealth urban districts.
It's urban and some rural districts mm-hmm. as well. I mean,
are
I think
facing this.
Well, maybe not the takeover, but I'm just saying, like, yeah. I think that there's these problems yeah. are you know, they're mostly socioeconomic.
So I want to ask Andy a question I think I know the answer to. When the state takeover happens, do any additional resources come with that?
I think there is some funding available. I'm not actually sure about that, but I think that the state ends up paying more attention to that district and they might be able to divert some more resources. That's a good question, though. I'm not exactly sure.
What about Paulo Di Maria, the state superintendent? What does he think about all this?
He hasn't weighed in on it that much, but it should be noted that he was not the state superintendent when this bill – he was about two superintendents ago. So that remains to be seen. There are other groups who say – the Fordham Institute, for one, who says that actually – in order to improve this process that we currently have, that there should be more buy-in from the state superintendent, where that state superintendent should actually have more oversight into the process, where the Academic Distress Commission should be reporting to that superintendent more to be weighing in on the process more. Another thing that the Fordham Institute says, and we should note, the Fordham Institute is an educational research center, but they also run a few charter schools in Ohio. They also say that that the state should try to keep a low amount of schools that are on academic distress. So they don't want the state to all of a sudden have 10, 15 school districts in academic distress. And we're sort of verging on that right now. There's one school district coming up this year. The Dayton City Schools, if they get another F on their report card, they could go into academic distress.
And so they go into academic distress, the state takes it over. Do they have deadlines or anything? Does the state have any deadlines for improving the situation?
Not necessarily any deadlines.
It could go on.
And this was one of the biggest.
There's no sunshine on
right.
any of this.
And this
I
was,
would imagine sunshine, sunset is what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this was one of the biggest gripes from critics back when this law was passed. So back in 2015, everything that we're talking about right now was created through an amendment to an education bill that had nothing to do with this topic, but it was added in as an amendment. Then State Senator Joe Schiavone, who represented the Youngstown area, he got in his car and drove down to Columbus the night he found out that this was about to be added as an amendment, and said a lot of the things that we just talked about, that is there going to be enough local control in this process? What kind of resources are you going to give us? How long could this go on? Could this just go on for 10 years, 15 mm-hmm. years? How long can this go on? These have been some of the
gripes. And the amendment that was inserted into that education bill, did that come from the Kasich administration?
It was, yeah. And at the time, the administration was trying to play it off like, oh, you know, this isn't quite us, you know. But then later on, Governor Kasich said that this was him. He thought he would say stuff like, it's enough is enough. We can't let these school districts keep failing like this.
The whole thing, it sounds to me like it's maybe not well calculated. Obviously, resources have to have something to do with districts that are struggling, mm-hmm. in addition to all the things that Laura brought out. And so, you know, you've got a town like Youngstown that's already suffering badly economically, and then you come along and basically blame the local school board for the problems that the school district has and say it's a failing school. I wonder whether that's really very helpful.
Mm. We should also mention that, so like we said, a school district has to have three straight Fs on their overall report card.
Yeah.
Columbus just recently got its first F. So if they in 2 years, if they get Fs two more times, then Columbus could be in this situation too.
Mm.
Ashtabula City Schools, Canton City Schools, Euclid City Schools, Mansfield, Toledo. Those are a couple of the schools on the list that have one F on their report card right now.
Well, we'll follow those bills down the happy road called the Ohio General Assembly and see how they work. Another topic that's up for reform is the parole board. Laura Bischoff, what's going on there?
Well, you know, I've covered a lot of criminal justice issues, and Shirley Smith, who was a state senator from Cleveland, a Democrat, she was appointed to the parole board. She spent like 3 years on the board, and then she resigned December 31st and, you know, wrote a scathing criticism, 4 pages long, of what she saw as a toxic, secretive organization.
How long had she been on?
Like 3 years.
Okay.
The parole board is they have up to 12 members. They are appointed by the DRC director. It's a job that pays like maybe $100,000 or more. And Shirley Smith, you know, she just said that it's toxic, it's secretive. And so I sought to find out, you know, maybe put some more meat on that and find out what was going on. And I got a lot of letters from inmates who were complaining that, you know, one time they'd go to the parole board and they'd be told, well, you have strong community support, but the severity of the crime is such that we don't think you should be let out yet. And then the next time they go to the parole board, they'd find that they had strong community support, or they'd have strong opposition, but then they have no idea where the opposition is coming from. Or even I found cases where they were, if you get a misconduct ticket while you are in prison, even for something minor, like having a stolen piece of fruit from the chow hall, or this one guy had too much commissary, like too many bags of Doritos and Little Debbie's. And he got a ticket for it, and that was weighed against him, and he got a 3-year flop, like 3 more years in prison.
Because he's got a Dorito thing.
Yeah. And, you know, the new DRC director, Annette Chambers-Smith, told me that the reason why they consider those behavior tickets is because if you can't follow the rules while you're in prison, what's to say that once you're out you're going to, you know, be able to follow rules? Anyway, there's a move to, you know, do some reforms. Chambers-Smith said she's interested in making some changes, including more transparency. What's interesting is that the initial parole meeting is not public. And then if it goes to a full board hearing, the full board hearings are public. They're open to the public, but they don't post their agenda ahead of time anywhere.
There's no law requiring them to?
Well, I would venture to guess that through the open meetings law, they should be doing that. And also, like, you know, you show up and there's no printed agenda. You don't know who's up, who they're considering, what order or anything like that. There's even a provision in state law that allows the crime victim to close the full board hearing for his or her portion of the testimony just to the media. So the media gets kicked out and then they bring you back in, which is strange.
In the preliminary hearing you talked about, they do it by video conference. It's not even recorded.
Right. There's no trans. There's a movement, the Ohio Justice Policy Center, which is a legal clinic based in Cincinnati. They're pushing for some reforms. They've actually filed a lawsuit against the parole board on behalf of one of their clients, Rhonda Head, who I think is... I can't remember where she's incarcerated right now, but she went up for parole. She had a release plan. She had everything all set, and they flopped her. And she asked, you know, what's the underlying documents that you're using to make this decision? And they're suing to try to get access to those records. But the Justice Policy Center is like, you know, we really need more transparency. There needs to be transcripts. They also are advocating for what's called presumptive parole, where if you're sentenced to 15 to 30 years, their thinking is that you should, once you've done that 15 years, you should automatically be paroled unless there's a good reason to impose more time on you. For example, you had some sort of a violent rule infraction, not too many Doritos.
Another issue I've been told that plagues the parole board is almost everybody on the board has a background in the prison system. Some of them started their careers as guards. And the criticism is that creates sort of an adversarial outlook. You're looking at the people who are coming before you as the bad guys, and Shirley Smith told me it's almost automatically a rejection the first time you go before them.
Yeah, they have there's the Justice Policy Center says that they think there are unwritten rules, which is like the first flop policy. You know, the first time first time you go up, you're going to get continued. You're going to get with yeah.
But that's not written down anywhere.
No, not that we know of.
That's just what happens.
Yeah, and then there's the Ohio Innocence Project has represented clients before the parole board, and you know, for people who have maintained their innocence, that they are innocent and they're not going to. They go to the parole board and they're expected to, to express remorse. And a lot of them are like, I'm not going to express remorse for a crime I did not do. And so then they will be, held for longer.
Hmm. We need to take a quick break. We will be right back. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. We've been talking with Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News about the parole board issues. Also with us, Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter, and Marty Schladen, Columbus Dispatch reporter. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Marty Schladen, I mean, you've covered the parole board, too. This has been going on forever. I mean, what's the likelihood do you think that there's ever going to be any real changes? Because we've been hearing these kind of stories for forever.
I think there's a chance, and Laura may know better than I, but we have a new governor, and he seems to be pretty determined to deal with long festering problems. And there are a lot of people who are not just dovetails with another issue, and that's this feeling that we've got like right at 50,000 people locked up in Ohio prisons, and there are people who feel like that's too many. And, you know, you've got a parole board that's handing out these flops like they're handing out candy at Easter time, and they're just, summarily adding years onto people's prison sentences. And as you were pointing out, that's probably $30,000 to $50,000 a year.
Per person, yeah.
You know, there's no shortage of criminal justice reform issues that are these long festering things. There's a Senate bill pending right now that would change criminal drug sentencing mm-hmm. laws, and it's sort of in response to issue
one
that failed last year. But I think the lawmakers saw an opportunity to make changes and try to, divert low-level, nonviolent first-time offenders who – you know, maybe their offense is related to their drug problem to, get them treatment rather than lock them up. Another, long festering thing is bail reform.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that Maureen O'Connor, the Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, the ACLU of Ohio, and the Buckeye Institute all agree on, which I always figure if you get those three parties agreeing on something, it's a pretty interesting issue. And that would be to switch from a cash bail system to more of a risk assessment. That way, the big drug dealer who's got deep pockets can't just buy his release, whereas the poor guy who can't, can barely scrape any money together doesn't end up stuck in jail awaiting trial because he wants to exercise his constitutional rights to say I'm not guilty. And there's a big pressure on folks like that to just say, fine, I'm going to plead to this because I got to get out or I'm going to get fired from my job. And
right.
I got to make rent and I got to do this and I got to do that. You know, so you see a bunch of different issues that the legislature has long been struggling with, and I wonder if this is the session in which they're going to make some progress on it. The other one is they just introduced another bill to prohibit execution of inmates who had serious mental illnesses at the time of the crime. And that is a bill that did it make it through the House last time?
I think it made it through the House and not through the Senate. It almost got there last year. It almost passed out of both chambers.
And it's been reintroduced. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that was among the 54 recommendations that this giant task force that was put together maybe 4 or 5 years ago made. They kind of nibbled around the edges and made some of the changes, but the major elements of it have not been put in place.
The idea of criminal justice reform is definitely getting momentum in the state house. I would also say that because we already passed the state house has already seen the heartbeat bill pass out of both chambers. So one of those big polarizing issues that usually just floats around the House and Senate for 2 years is now gone. And you do hear that you do get the sense of an appetite of both among both Democrats and Republicans that they want to work together on these bigger, longer festering issues that Laura was talking about. And I think that's where we're going to hear about criminal justice reform more. I also think because this seems to be sort of the trend lately is that somebody puts an issue on the statewide ballot and then the legislators say, no, don't vote for this.
We'll take care of it.
So just don't vote for it, and then we'll take care of it. We saw that with marijuana, and then they passed medicinal marijuana, mm-hmm. and now we're seeing it here. And I think that also puts a little fire behind them to get this done because they don't want to deal with a statewide ballot issue again. So criminal justice reform, sentencing reform, bail reform. So that one, there's actually a group working through the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor gathered that committee together. And from what I've heard, there's a lot of people who among the same groups that Laura was talking about, the Buckeye Institute, the ACLU, who are working together. And they seem to be finding common ground on where they want to move forward with that.
I just want to make a point about how complicated this problem is to solve, though, and why it's so long festering. You know, part of it is public policy hasn't been as enlightened maybe as it could have been. But also, I think it was the ACLU of Ohio earlier this year did a survey of the bills that got introduced last session, and something like 14% of them would have carried criminal prison terms. Mm-hmm. They were creating new crimes, in other words. And that's part of – in society, we are a lot more concerned about child rape than, a generation ago or two generations ago, mm-hmm. things like that. So there, as we discover problems, people say naturally there ought to be a law. And so that's a dynamic that's at play here too when you look at how many people are locked up.
Right. And there's always been a long appetite to be tough on crime. And
everyone's running for sheriff.
That's right.
Every 2 years, everyone's running for sheriff.
Yeah.
So no one wants to be look weak on crime, soft on crime.
Well, now the saying is be smart on crime.
Oh, okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. And with us, Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Another issue that has popped up is the issue of mayor's courts. The ACLU has investigated them. What did they find, Laura Bischoff?
Well, they found that a lot of them...
what do they do, first of all?
Well, mostly it's – I think it's
– like traffic?
Yeah, mostly it's traffic and minor misdemeanors. And it's – I think it's of any municipality that doesn't have a municipal court and has a population of more than 200 is allowed to have a mayor's court.
Okay.
And they found a pattern where basically they're ginning up a lot of revenues, Like there's a couple of the villages or little burgs that collected like more than $500,000 in traffic ticket fines for their small spots in just a single year. Mm-hmm. And the and also there's like not a lot of training required for the mayors or the magistrates who run these courts. And I think that they've also said that there's a lack of documentation and transcripts of the proceedings. So they also came up with a list of 51 places in Ohio in which you're likely to get – they're running speed traps. And I did a separate story on that, and that was very popular online. People really want to know that information.
Wasn't there a really
where to pump the brakes?
Wasn't there a really notorious one up in the Cleveland area?
I think Bradenhall.
That sounds right.
Or Bradenhall? I'm not sure how to pronounce it. And was it North Olmsted? There was a bunch. They're sprinkled all across the state.
And, you know, I don't know exactly what the legal setup was in Ferguson, Missouri, but there's a lot of room for mischief here. And what they were doing in Ferguson, Missouri was raising a bunch of money on the backs of poor black residents, and they rebelled.
These mayor's courts tend to disproportionately
stop African-American drivers.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Right, and there's a number of them that they'll also write you multiple tickets for the same stop, you know, like speeding, broken taillight.
No seatbelt,
you know, mm-hmm. Your tags expired, et cetera.
And what is the ACLU proposing the General Assembly do?
Well, one of the things they said is, like, just get rid of the mayor's courts in the large urban areas where it's easier. It's actually probably easier to just go to the municipal court for your ticket than go to mayor's court. And then also increase if you're going to keep them, increase the training requirements. I think it's only maybe like 6 hours of training to, you know, be the mayor who runs the mayor's court.
Less time than you take to learn how to drive a car.
Yeah.
Less time required to get a concealed carry license right now. But that might be done away with too, with another bill that is pending in the state house.
Yeah. Andy says that, like, okay, heartbeat's off the table, so now they can focus on real issues. But there's plenty of hot-button issues they can still deal
distract
with.
Them.
Sure, like the gun issues, for one.
Issues. And there's another thing going on at the State House, too, where I was talking to a couple of Democrats and Republicans, and I said, hey, it seems like you guys are maybe working together a little better than usual. And they said, yes, but the issue that's coming up now is that the Senate and the House don't seem to be working together really well.
Oh,
so that's another thing to be.
Something dysfunctional family. Eric in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Hi, Eric.
Good morning. You were talking about police speed traps.
Yeah.
One that is locally that is notorious is the village of Bryce with their high level of traffic citations that they have given motorists in that area.
Okay. Well,
and you do. You do have. So when you take Columbus and then you start moving a little further out and a little further out, and then all of a sudden you have Bryce or Heath or Lithopolis. And I'm not naming these people as, like, I'm not sure if all these places have that reputation. But you do kind of move out to those areas that might be having more budgetary problems. As you move,
and this
out.
Is a,
oh, that was
this
a, that
is
was
a stream of this is a funding stream for them. Mm-hmm.
That was another recommendation from the ACLU, which was restore state funding to the local governments because Maureen O'Connor, again, the Ohio Supreme Court Justice or Chief Justice, about a year and a half ago, issued a letter to all the judges, kind of based on that what was going on in Ferguson, just saying, look, hey, you know, the defendants are not an ATM. To fund the courts. You know, the money has to be, should be in the budget and not off the backs of, fines and fees, et cetera, folks.
And it's important to remember, you know, if your income is pretty low, you can drown under these debts. Mm-hmm. And then I believe in Ohio, warrants can be then issued for you.
Yeah, and that was another thing that some of the mayor's courts were doing was, like, threatening people with arrest.
If they don't pay up.
Pay up.
Transparency, you said, is lacking as well.
Yeah, again, they don't really have. It's not like a regular court where you'd have a court
report transcribing it and that kind of
exactly.
A thing. And any lawmakers talking about this?
Not that I know of, but I don't think they're very fond of speed traps.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
It sort of sounds like the debate that we heard over red light cameras. when it comes to generating revenue, and like you said,
same with the front license plate. I think the opposition to the front license plate, I think, had a lot to do with speed, getting clocked on the radar gun. The other big issue pending in the legislature is House Bill 6, which is that energy bill.
Yes, and I want to get to that. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. We're off criminal justice and on to energy. So stay with us. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. Marty Schladen from the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. We have Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch with us today. The company that owns Ohio's two nuclear plants has proposed some kind of change to the energy bill that's moving through the Ohio General Assembly, right?
Yeah. House Bill 6 got introduced. This has got the backing of Speaker Larry Householder and his team. And it would do away with renewable energy standards and some energy efficiency.
Haven't those already been done away with, though?
No, they were frozen, and then there was an attempt to repeal, and then that repeal was vetoed. And,
okay. So yeah. This would kill them off. Mm-hmm. And
First Energy and First Energy Solutions were the big driving force behind trying to get rid of those green energy standards.
Mm-hmm. And First Energy Solutions would be a major beneficiary of this new House Bill 6 because it would charge customers across the state, not just in First Energy's territory.
Which is around Akron.
Right. $2.50 a month for residential customers, like $20 a month for commercial, $2,500 for industrial. And this would gin up about $300 million a year.
Yeah.
And the Ohio Air Quality Development Authority would have control over this money, and they would basically issue grants to clean energy providers.
So
the nuclear plants would be considered clean energy providers, and they would be eligible for $9.25 per megawatt generated. So you do the math, and First Energy Solutions, or they're in bankruptcy right now, so I guess they're creditors, would be eligible for a little over half of the $300 million that's ginned up every year on this. And it's basically a big bailout for the two aging nuclear power plants, Perry and Davis-Besse. Both of them are along the Lake Erie shore.
What would the bailout achieve, though? I mean, would the plants continue operating?
Right. So they would continue to operate the nuclear power plants.
So here's what's happening with nuclear right now, and this is why people are upset about it. They back when First Energy was all for deregulation, they had these two nuclear plants that were operating at a pretty good level and making money in the marketplace. Then in 2008, there was the shale boom. Natural gas started coming online at a much cheaper rate. More wind and solar started coming online. Efficiency energy programs started coming online. So all of a sudden, you now have this energy marketplace that's way more competitive, and it costs more to run these nuclear plants. It also costs more to run older coal plants. That's why you see coal retiring at a faster rate. And so what First Energy Solutions is saying is that nuclear still provides a beneficial energy source to Ohio because it still provides 15% of Ohio's energy. All of that energy is carbon emissions free. So there's still a use for it. There's still a reason why it should continue to be around. They also employ about 1,400 people. So those are the arguments for keeping nuclear around, even though they are struggling and they're not doing well in the marketplace, and that's why opponents call it a bailout.
The other half of that $300 million pool would be open for grants for other other energy providers that, you know, do clean or cleaner energy. So even like a coal-fired plant, if they made some significant improvements to reduce their emissions, then they could be eligible for this clean energy fund.
A coal plant can be eligible for a clean air credit. If they reduce, I mean, they would never get rid of.
In Ohio's world. Yeah.
I know that this baseload argument's been made that they're putting 15% of the power onto the grid. Is that really an issue in Ohio? Do we not have, I mean, I know we're part of the PJM Interconnect and there's lots of people putting power onto the grid.
It's not an issue. Well, it depends on what you mean by issue, because there are people who say if you get rid of that 15%, it could easily be made up through coal, through gas. But the problem is you lose a little bit of that diversity. So your energy portfolio is not as diverse as it once was. You also have to build more transmission lines to make up for that energy, to spread out that base load more. So there are other costs at play there. So obviously you would assume that the gas industry wants this to happen, because that just means that more people, that gas can put more into the pipeline.
The natural gas, right?
Yeah, because again, what we're seeing is we're seeing a plummet in the use of coal. And coal, I mean, AEP has already planned to retire more of their coal plants going forward. So, you know, 10, 20, 30 years down the line, we're going to see a dramatic reduction in coal as well. And if nuclear is gone, then it's really just gas and then renewables.
There's opponent testimony scheduled this week in committee on this bill. It's in a subcommittee. You know, there's a lot of environmental groups, consumer groups that are against it. AARP Ohio issued a pretty strong letter against it, just because they, you know, it's going to cost consumers across the state.
Regardless of ability to pay. An additional $2.50 a month.
Right, for the residential. And you know, the Speaker Householder argues that, well, we're going to get rid of these other fees that people pay for the energy efficiency and the renewable energy standards.
Go ahead, Andy. I'm
sorry. I mean, if you don't mind getting complicated when it comes to cost, so that's a whole other debate in itself. So this bill would have every customer paying $2.50 a month. Right now, on average, if you take all of the state and you average it out to the average home, you pay about 50 cents a month for these renewable energy portfolio standards. Then you have another thing that's out there when it comes to these green energy standards, but it's harder to understand how much that actually costs a consumer, and that's called the Energy Efficiency Peak Demand Rider. And so that has a whole other charge to it. But what supporters of that rider say is if it's an energy efficiency rider, then you're actually paying for a program to save you money in the long run, because you're actually bringing down – you're making more energy efficient choices. So that's sort of just the foundation of the argument about the cost here.
Yeah, go ahead, Marty.
I was just going to ask, you know, politically bailouts aren't all that popular. Is Householder all alone on this among the big three? What do you think the politics are?
You mean, the Senate, the House, and the governor? Yeah.
Governor DeWine has expressed interest in keeping the nuclear power plants open, and Larry Obhoff has said that the majority of his members want to take steps to do so, although I think that really the devil's in the details. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where they stand on the specifics of House Bill 6.
There was a bill to do something very similar to this that went – that just stalled in the Senate for 2 years, and that would grant zero emission credits to nuclear power plants. That would be an extra cost along with the current green energy standards, and that didn't get met.
I think also, you know, like, wasn't it like 15 years ago during the whole deregulation debate that they put stranded costs onto bills so that we ended up paying for the nuclear power plants already?
Yeah.
This is going to be like, hey,
part of the debate.
Right. Now it's going to be like, hey, let's pay for them again.
In general, what is the, you know, when they had the clean energy requirements and then they froze them and then they watered them down, what's the outlook for Ohio as a state that's welcoming to what we traditionally think of as clean energy, which are renewables.
Well, one of the main things that's not addressed in House Bill 6 is the wind farm setbacks.
Yeah.
They changed. It used to be you could put your windmill farms up and they could be closer to property lines. And then they changed the setback rules, what, like 3 or 4 years ago?
Mm-hmm. It was in an MBR, so it was, yeah.
And anyway, as a result, it's a lot harder to build a wind farm. And, you know, I asked Speaker Householder, I said, well, you know, you're trying to encourage clean energy generation. Why not deal with helping the wind farms, you know, be in a better position? This is a hurdle for them right now. Why not remove that hurdle so that they're in a better position to build wind farms? And he said he thought that it's better to deal with that in a standalone bill and that it has to it's kind of tangled up in property rights debates.
The wind industry might be hesitant to say this completely outright publicly, but they will say that the wind setback laws are more detrimental to developing wind energy in Ohio than the green energy standards are. Supporters of the standards would tell you that it did a really good job encouraging people to come to Ohio and create renewable energy to develop new projects. There is also a provision to encourage Ohio-made renewable energy. Mm-hmm. There's also credits where you can buy the support the energy in a place like Indiana. Supporters of green energy standards would tell you that doing this would be sort of a slap in the face to solar and wind because this was something that was working already. It's a little cleaner than what we have right now. And it just is another step towards discouraging the development of these energy sources in Ohio.
Also, keep in mind that First Energy Solutions and its allies have spent, you know, millions of dollars in campaign contributions over the last several years. Call me a skeptic. Call me jaded, yeah. But I think that maybe campaign contributions and policy are...
You jaded skeptic.
Jaded skeptic. Yeah. I think that there might be a link there.
And there are people out there who would want us to note that First Energy Corp and First Energy Solutions are now two separate companies, but that's only a recent development. They were the same company for years when they were fighting for these issues in the past. Right now, they're two separate companies, and First Energy Solutions is in the middle of a bankruptcy case.
I have to say, I spent a lot of my career in Texas, and Ohio's resistance to wind energy is really a mystery to me. There's no lobby in Texas stronger than the oil and gas lobby, but as a matter of public policy, they embraced wind generation, and now they're the biggest wind generating state in the country. And, I cannot understand why we wouldn't want to do that in Ohio.
Where coal used to be king.
Mm-hmm. Part of its property rights, there are groups. So if you go up to northwest Ohio in places like Hardin County, Van Wert, Paulding, and Seneca, different counties sort of embrace energy differently depending on who's leading up there. And you drive through Seneca County and people have yard signs that say no wind here. No, like we're in no wind. And then you cross over to a different county and it's we support wind energy. So it's a whole property debate up there.
But the state hasn't had any compunction, Ohio lawmakers, I should say, about restricting local laws regarding fracking and fracking waste. They don't seem to have the same interest in wind energy is the bottom line.
Well, I do think that, solar and wind, they are, once they get a bigger foothold, their costs would be way lower than fossil fuels. And so eventually I think that they could be a competitor. So maybe it's the fossil fuel industry doesn't want them to get a foothold.
You would hear from legislators in Northwest Ohio who on the Senate and House floor would point to their colleagues and say, hey, you in East Ohio, you have shale right now and you're benefiting from shale. You in Southeast Ohio, you had coal. You're benefiting from that. give me this, give me the win that we can capitalize on in Northwest Ohio. But it just hasn't seemed to stick.
I just want to shift gears real quick and talk about the governor's budget. Governor Mike DeWine's budget exceeds the spending growth limits, and it's going to need cutting. Have any of you guys been covering this and what the outcome could tell us?
We were just talking about this because this is actually going to be a big issue soon, and we were hearing from leaders in the House who said that they hope to get moving on this budget bill soon, but they have a lot of issues to deal with, especially when it comes to whose numbers are right. So we're looking at, you know, the DeWine administration is projecting a certain amount of revenue to spend, and then the LSC, the Legislative Service Commission, and their numbers, I think it's $700 million less. Is it? It might be something. I think
that's what it was from the beginning.
Yeah,
is what they were saying.
So we're dealing with this problem of who has the right projections here, and also we're butting up against this thing that I think Laura knows more about, the SAL, the something state adjusted limitations, where the state cannot spend more than 3.5% of what they spent the year before.
It's a way of kind of like restricting the growth of the budget and spending so we don't get runaway spending. And it links back to the at least 15 years ago when there was
it's a 2006 law.
Right. And it was heading to, I think there was a couple of states that were doing this tax something or other limitation, the TEL, which I think Colorado had one. I'm sorry that it's so vague, 15 years I hadn't memorized everything. But anyway, the idea is that they can't have this runaway spending. There's a law that kind of like puts a brake on it. And the question is, are they going to bump up against that?
Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of lawmakers saying that they're not feeling very comfortable where they're at right now because they could be exceeding that limit.
And keep in mind, this all has to get buttoned up by June 30th.
Well, yeah,
it's got to get through the House, the Senate, and then the governor's got to go through it and do his line item vetoes, blah, blah, blah. And the fact that they didn't agree on the transportation budget, by the March 31st deadline makes me wonder if there's enough discord over these issues that it's not going to. Don't plan your vacation for early July.
The same thing. Yeah. Yep. I was going to have a late night on June 30th, maybe.
Right.
After the fight over the transportation budget, do you think there are some lingering hard feelings?
I just think that, I think so. I think that the speaker, saying it's time to take your binky out of your mouth and put your big boy pants on and get this job done wasn't well taken by the members of the Senate.
Right. Mm-hmm. Again, the problem is the discord's now between the two chambers.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you remember the transportation budget, there were Democrats and Republicans on the Senate side who agreed on the Senate's plan. Same thing, both parties agreed on the House's plan. So it's really these two chambers that are rubbing up against each other that have this friction now.
But, the way the government is designed is to have checks and balances among the three branches of government and the bicameral legislature. We're not supposed to have like a, rubber stamp.
Even though it's completely and
it's all Republican controlled.
But that's something, for outsiders, I know I didn't realize this until I started covering a state house. I think outsiders tend to see party differences as the only differences. And these intramural rivalries, one chamber versus the other, can be really fun to watch. And maybe
you're
that's
a
what
sick
we got.
Man, Marty. we are just about out of time. I think that the other stripes in the Ohio General Assembly are urban, rural. There's a lot of other suburban. There's just a lot of different things that separate people. And that all comes to the fore whenever one party takes as much control as as the Republican Party has in the Ohio, not just the General Assembly, but, state government writ large. So
right.
It's pretty interesting. Marty Schladen, you're not a sick man. I appreciate
you don't hear me arguing, do you?
Of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter, thanks for joining us, as always.
Happy Monday.
And Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, appreciate all your help today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.